You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't decide.
Alright, we're gonna slide right into talking to James Ferguson. James, first of all, good morning. Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
No, first of all, James, man, you never became Jim or Jimmy or Jim Bob Corncob. What's up with that?
Yeah, most of the time, especially in Marine Corps, it was the last name, as most of us experienced. So typically, it was just Ferg. But my dad is Jim, so that's the way I was always distinguished as a kid.
So, James. You know, somebody asked, our kids, John, Patrick, Catherine, and Colleen, somebody said, why are you guys so formal? And we said, like, what do you mean? Well, you call Patrick Patrick. Well, that's what we named him. So what are we going to call him, Shemp? Not yet, anyway. Well, what about Catherine? Well, no, we like Catherine. And we think it's a pretty name, so that's why we call her Catherine. Like, oh, okay. But there's always a story behind it. So, your dad, Jim. We're going to talk about the Warrior Reunion Foundation, with Ferg here. But, before we do that, we're going to learn about him. Born and raised where?
Born and raised Rockville Center, New York, town Long Island in Nassau County, about 30, 40 minutes outside New York City.
So that means if you go with the stereotype, that means you're a Mets, Islander, Jet guy. Yes?
Yeah, you know, I like to buck the trend. So I'm a Yankees, Giants guy. I did root for the Islanders as a kid, but kind of stopped following hockey after about high school.
Yeah, because then the Islanders started sucking. What about there's no coincidence there. A lot of Islanders fans a lot of Islander fans did the same thing. What? How fired up are you about the Yankees today?
I'm pretty excited, man. I think this is, you know, it was interesting last year because lower expectations, which is not something Yankees are used to, and they really rose to the occasion and surprised a lot of people. Now it's kind of back to the whole dominant team, dominant force, and so it'll be interesting to see how the young players change their approach based on those higher expectations. But I'm hopeful it's all going to come down to the pitching staff and if they can stay healthy.
You know, but it is what's interesting about a lot of teams, the Dodgers, the Yankees, kind of in the same boat, is there is so much young talent in baseball. I don't know that I've ever seen, and I've been watching it since I was a kid, when my dad was involved in it, but I don't know that I've ever seen a time where you have more young, talented teams, and that young talent is so good. Houston's team is a young team. The Dodgers team is a young team. Cleveland's got a pretty young team. The Yankees have the youngest team they've ever had. They have the seventh highest payroll. That's not Yankee life.
I know.
The Dodgers the Dodgers team is a bunch of young guys. And so it's, the Cubs team is a bunch of young guys. So it's, pretty interesting, pretty exciting if you're a baseball fan, just the amount of young talent that's in baseball. And so
there's a lot of energy in the game.
Yeah.
A lot of energy. It's fun to watch.
And so if you're a Yankee fan, it's kind of a different experience in that not only are they good, but they're really young and they're going to get even younger because they've got younger players that are coming up that are really good too. So opening day today.
Yeah. As long as they can resist that Yankee temptation to trade them all away. 35-year-old guy at the deadline.
Yeah. We don't need A-Rod again. Okay. We can live without that.
No.
We can live without that. All right, so that's where you're born and raised. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
My dad was a Marine long before I was alive, late 60s, early 70s. Service was something that was always important in our family. My grandpa landed on D-Day on Omaha Beach and was decorated with the Silver Star, serving in the infantry there. And
what was he?
So it was always something I knew.
Who was he with?
Armored Infantry Unit. I couldn't tell you the name off the top of my head. The citation is in my parents' dining room along with the French Croix de Guerre, so my dad's pretty proud of that, and that was always something that,
wow.
Yeah, we would hear the stories and stuff. I was like the 14th or 15th Irish Catholic family, grandchild by that time, so grandkids were kind of old news, and he was about 85 years old when I was old enough to have a conversation with him, so we never really talked about it. I wish now that
right. After
my experiences, we would have had the chance to have those conversations, but anyway, so, you know, service was always something important in our family. It was always something I knew I wanted to do in some capacity. And then 9/11 happened. I was a high school kid on Long Island, and that was the point for me that solidified everything of like, okay, I have to do something here. And I know that it's going to be service in the military. And then it came down to which branch are you going to choose? And for me, it was, you know, I had a pretty comfortable childhood, certainly not rich or anything by today's standards, but I never really wanted for anything as a kid. We were very blessed, and so I thought about the Marine Corps as a way to really prove myself, earn something that nobody could say that was given to you because of your upbringing and where you came from and your privilege or whatever. I wanted to do something where it's just a completely level playing field, and I know I could be proud of the fact that I accomplished this based on merit and nothing else. So that's what really drew me to the Marine Corps.
So did you have a choice? I mean, your dad's a Marine. Did he serve in Vietnam?
He did not, no. And it's funny, we have conversations now, and it's one of his big regrets, I think. But he just never got orders, which is interesting. He had two brothers who served in Vietnam, my Uncle Johnny and my Uncle Huey. Johnny was in the Army, and Huey was in the Navy. And my dad was in for about 3 years, and there was a rift, and he was serving as a security force person at a naval base in, I think it was Rhode Island or Connecticut or something, but he's a, you know, 03, but just doing a security mission and was never deployed.
So you look at the Marine Corps. So do you go to college? Do you enlist out of high school? What do you do?
No, I was going to, I had this idea that I was going to enlist at high school because, again, 9/11 happened, and I guess I was a sophomore at the time. And my dad kind of talked some sense into me about, like, hey, you're not ready for this yet. And he was right. And you have the ability to go to school. The Marine Corps is not going anywhere. I'm pretty sure this conflict is not going anywhere for a while. Go to school, get an education. You'll have more to offer, and you'll be a little bit more mature because you're not ready for this right now. And he was right, and I listened begrudgingly, and I had played around with the idea of a few times, kind of hanging it up and just going, but ended up going to school, University of Delaware, went through OCS, the platoon leaders course, the summer between my junior and senior year, and then was commissioned in May of 2007. And headed off to the basic school.
All right, so you go to the basic school, and what do you become? What did you want to be?
I went there thinking I wanted to be an infantry officer, and then I realized that going to the field is a real pain in the ass. So I was like, yeah, I still want to do this fun ground combat stuff. I just don't want to be in the field all the time. So I was wise enough to put artillery at the top of my list.
Oh, easy now.
Be
very careful, okay? Be very careful.
Yeah. I think I fell asleep during the briefing where they may have shared how often the artillery goes to the field. So I ended up putting artillery number one and got it. And so I ended up being an artillery officer.
All right. So talk. Give us a thumbnail about your career. You hit the fleet in what year?
Yep. Hit the fleet in, so let's see, TBS graduation was July of 2008. Then about 5 months of, a little bit of OJT out at 11th Marines. There was a gap there because artillery officers, we use the Army's artillery school, so the dates don't always line up. My class had to wait a little bit. 5 months of artillery training, I think it was... It was in February of 2009, I guess, by the time I actually hit the fleet. something like that. That makes sense. And 1st Battalion, 11th Marines, India Battery, 312, which is assigned to 111. But I was kind of the bastard children of that battalion, and that was a label that we lived up to fully and tended to embrace. And spent my fleet tour out there, served in all the different roles that a company grade artillery officer would have. So spent a little bit of time, as an FO, and then moved into guns platoon and the FDC. And then as we started ramping up for the deployment I made with India Battery, to Afghanistan, we started moving into a more distributed operations firing platoon model. So you're the fire direction officer and the platoon commander, expecting to be shooting out of a firebase in support of maneuver, and not necessarily co-located with the rest of your battery or with battery headquarters or anything like that. So it was kind of a new operational model for us, but really prepared us well for what we ended up doing, which was completely not what we trained for with respect to the pre-deployment training.
So you deployed to Afghanistan what year?
We deployed in 2010. So I left in April with advance party. I think the rest of the battalion, 111 deployed as a battalion, and the majority of, you know, the overwhelming majority of the battalion did that artillery mission and did it tremendously well, providing those long-range fires and support maneuver out there. Our unit, India 312, was detached from 111, and we moved over under RCT-2. At the time, then, Colonel Paul Kennedy was the RCT commander, and we were sent up to the Kajaki Dam and did a rip with the British Royal Marines up there as they were transitioning out of the area. So we relieved Delta Koi 40 Commando up at the Kajaki Dam and took on the provisional infantry mission at the dam there as the first American unit as part of that force that was coming into to Helmand to take control of that battle space.
Okay, explain to everybody what a Koi is.
A Koi is a company. They just, for some reason, that's their abbreviation and that's what they call it.
Yeah, the Brits got to be a little bit different, okay? So it's got to be a little bit different. And so that's where the whole Koi comes from. What? Who?
Sometimes they're a lot of bit different, I'll tell you. Man, they're fun to work with, but I'll never forget. We had to helo in everything, all the roads in and out of Kajaki, the 611s, the main, you know, thoroughfare up through Goreshk and then through Sangin.
Okay, hold on. Before you get to that, I want you to answer. Was it your convoy that screwed up Patterson's LD at 5 in the morning? Was that you?
No. We had no convoys. I can tell you that very confidently. We were air inserted into Kajaki, and we didn't have any vehicles because they were too heavy to lift in for us. So the only vehicles we had were some up-armored Humvees that we were not allowed to ride in. The only thing we were allowed to do is pre-clear the path on foot, and then they could roll behind us with just a driver and an aid driver in case we needed a CASAVAC, or, you know, they would tow extra ammo or stuff like that for us. But we were not able to ride in any of our vehicles.
Okay, just wanted to get that out of the way. All right, so continue about the Kajaki Dam.
Yeah, so just, you know, I was thinking about the Brits when you brought it up, and I'll never forget coming down from the LZ. We had just been air inserted, and I'm trying to get my bearings. I'm like, okay, where am I? What's going on here? And we're coming down the side of this big ridge line, which is where the LZ is, that's right behind the FOB. And we come into the gate of the FOB, and the first thing I see are a couple of guys wearing nothing but Speedos with the Union Jack on their ass.
What?
And it was like one of those, yeah.
One of those.
My first arm almost lost his mind.
One of those Apocalypse Now moments. Like,
absolutely. That's what I was going to say. Like, where did I just get dropped into? And there's like feral dogs running through the camp, and yeah, I mean, it was unbelievable.
Okay, one of our fun stuff to talk about now. Ferg, one of our favorite topics of discussion here is explaining what a dog in Afghanistan looks like. Is it?
Yeah, I listened to you and Joe talk about it a little bit.
Is it anything close to what an American would conceive of as a dog?
not in any place I've ever been. I can say that. It is, well, you guys, you know, the ears and the tails are often cut off and they can be pretty mangy. So it was interesting though. So the ones that lived on the fob, because the Brits actually took them in and fed them and made friends with them and allowed them to, and they were fiercely loyal to the Brits and to us, the ones that actually lived in and around the fob. So they weren't vicious with us at all. And they would actually come out. There were two, named AK and Dishka for obvious reasons, that would come out on patrol with you, and they would walk ranger file in the patrol. No, I'm not kidding. And it was great to have them because they knew if an Afghan was around way before we did. And so we started being able to pick up on, okay, someone's in this area, even if we can't see them. I mean, when you're down in the green zone, if the corn's high or something, you can't see too far, but they knew when somebody was around. And they were vicious with the Afghans. They did not like the local population at all. And then it was the reverse as we're going through little towns and stuff. Of course, if they had their big monster dogs chained up on the roofs of these compounds and stuff, but those we did not want anything to deal with. But the ones that the Brits had raised were pretty good to go and were great for us.
Wow, interesting. All right, so you came back. When did you get out of the Marine Corps?
So that deployment was, I was there April to November of 2010. Got back, was the XO for the unit for about 6 months. Got orders to Quantico, served as the aide to the CG at Marine Corps Recruiting Command, which was a pretty interesting job and kind of opened my eyes to the fact that I had a great boss, absolutely loved working for him, learned so much and still apply a lot of the – it was General Osterman. I think he's deputy at SOCOM now. We still keep in touch. He's pretty busy, but occasionally we'll exchange –
Jody,
it's just updating each other. Yeah, that's right.
Jody, we served together at IOC. I took over most of what he taught. Yeah. No, he's one of the smart, easygoing, very personable, and I think he trends to the quiet when you meet him personally, and but just a great, treats people great.
Yeah.
And he's great,
smart,
yeah, great officer.
Yeah,
great
and officer. The thing I got from him more than anything was it's not about you, and it's interesting. There's really I didn't see any middle of the road general officers. There were those, and thankfully they were in the majority in Marine Corps who understood that. And there were some, at least from my vantage point, and I'm a captain at the time, so what do I know? But who didn't understand that. And when you're working for one who does, you see what a difference it makes throughout the entire command. And the fact that no matter what, he was focused on, so we're at recruiting command, so he was just, his question every day was, what can I do to better support the sergeant on the ground at RSS,
whatever,
that is out there on the bag with a number to do every month. And that's what he was focused on. He didn't care about the clerical stuff at headquarters, and I mean, there are people who can handle that. He wanted to get out. We traveled every week. He wanted to go to every recruiting station. There's 48 of them in the continental United States. He wanted to go to every one that first year and actually sit down with the Marines and better understand what challenges are you facing? What can I do to better support you? What do I need to mobilize my staff back at Quantico to do to make sure you can accomplish your mission and to make sure your families are taken care of, because this is tough duty. And that really stuck with me, and it's something that I've tried to apply even post-Marine Corps. But anyway, I did that gig for a little over a year. He was getting ready to go back to Afghanistan for 15 months to work for General Dunford, and basically told me, like, hey, you're not allowed to come with me because you haven't even really wound down from your last deployment. And in retrospect, I greatly appreciated that as well, although at the time I was, you know, I wanted to go, but at the same time, you come back from deployment and then we're traveling every week to all these different recruiting stations. And my wife and I really had never, we'd gotten married right before that deployment to Afghanistan. Never even really had the chance to live together. So,
wow.
So that was good. And then I did another job on Quantico for about a year, which I enjoyed as kind of my serving out the rest of my time and left active duty in 2013, June of 2013.
Give me a lesson learned from your time at the Kajaki Dam was a pretty violent time. Give me a lesson learned from your time there.
Man, there's so many things.
Yeah, I only want one though. If I introduce you to my two sons that are a captain and a lieutenant, and said, "Hey, tell them one thing that they should know before they go to war," what would you tell them?
Trust your fellow Marines to the left and right if you're lucky enough to be a Marine, and if you're in a leadership position, give your guys the ability to make the decisions they need to make to bring their people home safe. That was the driving force every day. Was for me, the litmus test was, okay, we can do this, but if somebody gets hurt, do I know or am I fairly confident that I'm going to be able to get them taken care of and get them back? Because we were just in such a tough situation up there with being so separated from really any friendly forces, and we were outside the golden hour at the time. Which ended up being an issue, of course. So train your guys well and then trust them to do their job. Don't feel like you have to do everything yourself. I learned that lesson very quickly because you can't. And if you give them the ability, you give them resources they need to do the job, trust them to do it, and they will amaze you in ways that you maybe never expected.
Okay, explain outside the golden hour for people that don't understand that.
Yeah, so typically, when we have forces out there, operating on a daily basis in a combat environment, we want to keep them within an hour's transit of a Role 3 trauma facility. So, if somebody gets hurt, if we have, in our case, it was mainly IEDs. If somebody steps on an IED and all of a sudden it's a double amputee, and we've got tourniquets on both their legs, and they're losing blood, and we need to get them to a Role 3 trauma facility. Typically, if you can get them there within an hour from the moment they're injured, I think the statistic is unreal. It's in the high 90%, if not like 99%.
Yeah, it's over 95% easily that they're going to survive.
Right. But you got to get them there within that hour, which is why it's the golden hour. We were not within the golden hour. So the closest Role 3 for us when we got to Kajaki was back at Leatherneck, and I'm swagging it here, but if I remember right, it was close to 40 minutes one way on a helicopter. So by the time they picked up our wounded, the clock was running out. And so that was a real challenge for us. And it was just something that we had to work into every decision we made where, sometimes I look back and I'm like, man, I wish I was more aggressive in this situation, or I should have been maybe pushed a little bit further here. But it's like if one of my guys steps on an IED or gets shot and I know we can't get him there in an hour, is this worth that level of risk? So that was always a planning consideration for me that I took. That was the number one for me is the safety of my Marines and their well-being.
Well, it's no small consideration when you're, for instance, so if somebody functions an IED, and let's just say you get a radio call within 2 minutes, okay, of that event happening. So now you're at 2 minutes, right? It's going to be 15 minutes before that aircraft gets in the air. So now you're at 17.
Yeah.
And then you have 80 minutes. Well, you have 40 up, and let's just say 3 on the deck, and then you got 40 back. So that's 83 minutes plus 17. So you're talking about 100 minutes, an hour and 40 minutes before that guy's going to be on an operating table. And so absolutely should color the way you guys look at contact. And again, the first aid kits are not what those of you who were in the Marine Corps when you had the little green container with iodine and some water purification tablets and a single God's bandage and a bandana, a green bandana that you could use for a sling that most of the time got used for something else. That's not what a first aid kit looks like anymore. There's tourniquets, there's quick clot, there's all kinds of things, to help you stabilize somebody, that is pretty well busted up. But given that, 100 minutes, that's a long-ass time. Our medevacs were running less than 25 minutes. And, I mean, we even cut a drug deal with our air officers, where, God bless them. In fact, the only reason Kyle Carpenter's alive, Medal of Honor recipient,
I know Kyle a little bit.
The only reason he's alive is because of a guy named Rich Elaine and Kurt Knowles. And they went to our dust off guys and said, when you see an urgent medevac get posted before you're sourced, will you go and turn the aircraft? And they said, yeah. And that took maybe 10 minutes off the medevac, because when,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So when it would pop in a window, they'd plot the grid,
right? The rotors.
And they'd see in the AO where it was, and they'd say, that's going to be us. And then normally it takes for the TAC SWO to say, dust off, take them to Dwyer. And that takes them a few minutes to do. Well, then you run out to the aircraft and you spin it. They wouldn't wait. They would run. And so as soon as the TAC SWO said go, and it might be at the 5 minute mark, they had already warmed the aircraft up and they were lifting off. So we ran really fast medevacs. And then I'm going to say from Dwyer to the northern end of RAO was 12 to 15 minutes, depending on where they were.
Yeah, everybody tried.
Yeah, so you can be aggressive.
So many people try to help us.
Yeah, you can be aggressive, but unless they remote another surgical facility or something up to the dam, there's nothing you can do but color your operations and use more restraint. As much as you want to be more aggressive, that 100 minutes I'm sure was daunting as a commander.
It was, and everybody knew it.
I mean,
we knew it going in. It was part of the conversation that we had in every briefing, was this is something you guys have to be aware of and take into consideration with every decision you make. And people tried to shave time around the margins as much as they could. So we had the same situation, and we started getting smart about, like, hey, as soon as we hear an IED go off, because in our, like, just where we were, like, if it went off for one of our patrols, we heard it, and we could go outside and get visual confirmation or from one of our OPs, our COC at the company level would start spinning up a merc chat and use everything they could to get as much information as possible to get the rotors turning and at least get something up in the air, and we'll kind of refine that once you're en route. And so people worked with us to really try to shave it down as much as they could, but it was, you can't change distance. It was purely a distance thing.
Right. James Ferguson, former captain, United States Marine Corps, is my guest, and we're going to kind of switch gears here a little bit. We've been talking about his career in the Marine Corps and the challenges that being a commander up at the Kajaki Dam put in front of him. Question, though, how did Paul Kennedy treat you? He's a buddy of mine. Did you spend any time with him? Did he treat you okay?
We did. Yeah, so my first job as part of Advanced Party, I got sent to his headquarters at Del Ram, I think it was. And they were great. Like, he was the type of guy where he tried to push as many assets forward to us as possible. He understood the fight that we were in. He came up to see it for himself. He went out on patrol with my guys carrying a USOC 45 and a shotgun, which is all the Marines were like, hey, how do I get one of those?
This kind of modular looking shotgun. He used to walk around with it in Ramadi in 2004.
Like, I heard that because when I was telling the story to somebody else, they brought that up. But yeah, so I mean, imagine an artillery battery, and he gave us all the assets we could. I mean, they sent the regimental gunner up to us for like 2 or 3 weeks. Gunner Tom Beecher, who was amazing, and he was running ranges with our Marines up on the LZ on top of the ridgeline behind our FOB, teaching them how to use a Sasser, how to use javelins. It was just unbelievable. So imagine an artillery battery that has their own cannons. So they actually, airlifted two of our howitzers up there, and then a third. We've got 81s. We've got javelins. We've got a Sasser. And we're employing all these on our own. We didn't get any attachments to employ these things. Our Marines were cross-trained to do all this stuff.
Knowing what ass bags artillery guys are, that had to be scary as hell, huh? Yeah?
It was, I mean, you've got motor team Marines out there employing a Sasser. You've got artillery Marines employing the Sasser.
Okay, Ferg, explain to everybody what a Sasser is.
It's a 50 caliber sniper rifle, and it is badass. And it is often the only thing that will, I mean, sometimes not even that, but as you heard during that Sangin battle study, I mean, these compounds are pretty impressive in the way that they can take a beating and still provide great reinforced firing positions for the enemy. So the Sasser was one way that we were able to sometimes kind of get through that type of stuff, but often it came down to the Javelin. But the Sasser is a good piece of gear.
All right. Kennedy's. I met him when he was a first lieutenant. Came rolling out with his hands in his pocket to Combat Town to teach with me at the basic school. And we've been buddies ever since. He got my car high centered in a stream in Quantico, brand new Pathfinder. We're riding in it to go check out a training area. And when we come to the stream and I look at it, I'm like, this wood's too deep. And he looks at me and goes, buddy, you don't have a ball in your body if you don't cross this. I'm like, really?
Yeah, that's a really funny story because I was in a convoy with him through Sangin. So this is kind of a different, so
a little bit.
As 3-7 was, crossing the river into Sangin, we were in Kajaki. And then 3-5 was coming in to relieve them. So we actually got a detachment of 3-5 guys up at the dam to take over our police mentoring mission because we had a local AMP unit up there. That's a different story. But I say all this to say I ended up getting tasked with my battery gunny to go down to Sangin as 3-5 was coming in. Or actually, their advance party was there, but the rest of them weren't there yet. And we were on a convoy all through Sangin to every outpost. So some of the ones that Joe was mentioning, you know, I'd seen while the Brits were still employing them. And the Brits still controlled that battle space at the time. And we were sent out there to try to scout out an artillery position because the thought was they might take my platoon away from Kajaki, backfill us with, I guess, a grunt platoon, and then have us shoot artillery in Sangin for the guys in Sangin.
Wow.
It didn't end up happening, but I ended up going down there for this leader's recon. And so I was rolling through the Sangin Wadi. It was so fun listening to you guys talk about that. And hitting up all these different little outposts. And one of the vehicles in the convoy was Colonel Kennedy's vehicle because he was going to go up there and get eyes on this himself. And, we're rolling back into Fob Jackson and there's this little, I think it was Jackson. There's this little bridge, that is barely wide enough for an MRAP or an M-ATV to get across. And his vehicle, it's getting dark. We just come through a bazaar. His vehicle rolled off the bridge and right outside the FOB. And so the whole convoy was blocked, couldn't get in. So we're like, our ass is hanging out back into this bazaar. It's getting dark and I'm sitting there with my battery gun. You're like, it figures we would get pulled out of Kajaki to go to maybe the one place in the country that's more dangerous and more filled with people that hate us right now. It was just, nothing ended up happening, but that's another funny, Paul Kennedy story about a vehicle.
And whose vehicle was it that went off?
His vehicle. No, his vehicle.
His vehicle.
That's what came over the radio. I never saw it for myself, but they said, you know, that Colonel Kennedy's vehicle had, I don't know if it rolled all the way or if it just kind of dipped off or what, but we were probably sitting out there for 30, 40 minutes before they could figure out how to get everything back rolling and get us back into the gate at Father Jackson.
Nice. You know what? That's good to know. He'll have to account for that.
Give you a good story.
You know, the other thing, honest, I mean, he was towards the, you might have been gone already, but he was,
we were.
He was attacked. A guy grabbed a rock and smashed him in the face and knocked him. He was doing, you know, this bizarre walk, which everybody, all the regimental commanders did. You know, you get invited to these places, you know, and some guy grabbed a rock, put it in his hand, and then smashed him in the face. And I want to say, you know, knocked him down, and then hit him. I want to say a few more times before he was ultimately killed. And
yeah, his PTSD shot him. I remember we heard about that while we were back at Pendleton because we had developed a really good relationship with him. I mean, he really, you know, all joking aside, the support we got at Kijaki, what they could give us, what they had to give us.
He was, I'll tell you what, he's a funny guy too. So after we found out he was okay, you know, and, you know, you didn't know because supposedly the attack was violent and vicious, you know, and you get brain damage from something like that. And when I say rock, it was not like some smooth garden rock, okay? It was some jagged rock, pieces of concrete or whatever, and that, you know, assaulted, you know, hit him right in the face with. So anyway, but we gave him a little bit of bad time after that. Like, really?
Yeah, that was up near Black Rock. They did a convoy up there to kind of test this ceasefire and see if it was going to hold. And I remember hearing about that. One of my buddies was a CAT platoon commander with 3-5, and I think he was with them on that mission. I'm not sure if he was there at the time, but he told me about it.
All right, let's switch gears. Where does Warrior Reunion Foundation come from? How does that... and let me just tell you, the mission of All Marine Radio, post-combat related mental health, staying connected on Facebook, having a group text message event, which I do every day with 5 of my friends, just staying connected is incredibly, incredibly important. In fact, the battle study I did yesterday, if you can imagine, second lieutenant, 1975, they get thrown onto this island, and they get told there's between 15 and 45 dudes there. Echo and Golf Company 2-9 are going to go booming in. There's actually somewhere between 300 and 600 guys on the island with heavy weapons, and they get the shit. They get the shit shot out of them. They wind up leaving 3 Marines. It's an amazing thing that they got in and got out and did what they did, which is the story. But part of the story is 3 Marines were left there. A machine gun team was left there, and they find out years later that they were alive, and it was devastating for those guys.
And
you can imagine that. If you can imagine being the commander, right? You talk about the burden of the 100-minute medevac, but and then how you worry about it and whatnot, but. Yeah, it was devastating, and this Dan Hoffman, who came on yesterday, talked about how that put him into a tailspin, made his drinking worse, and stopped going out, stayed in the house, put on weight, lost his job, lost his marriage, and ultimately what saved him was reconnecting with his fellow Marines, and they got him to go to the VA, which turned his entire life around. So the whole connection thing is a theme that constantly plays out here on All Marine Radio. So how does this idea percolate in your head, and what's the initial iteration of it?
Yeah, so we got back from Kijaki November 2010. Within probably 6 weeks, they didn't have that 90-day stabilization thing in place. I think 3-5 may have been the first unit that had that in place, actually. So we, within 6 weeks, probably 60 to 70% of my battery, either PCS'd or EAS'd. And a lot of guys had extended to make that deployment in the first place. And it was great because we had spent years training together before making that deployment, which is one of the reasons we were able to be so effective. And our sergeants did such an amazing job as these provisional infantry squad leaders and all this stuff. But, you know, people were just gone. It was to the winds. We knew the opportunity to really process that experience and heal together. Our unit took about 25% casualties. We had 5 killed in action. 3 of them were from our platoon, 2 from the other. So it was a tough deployment. Those guys went through a lot. They went through hell together. And we were separated very quickly after that experience. And it takes time for some of that stuff to manifest. Years before you're ready to talk about certain things. But when you start being ready, or when you start needing to, even if you don't know you need to talk about some of those things, the people that you can talk about it with that actually get it because they were there with you are often not with you anymore. And so we kept in touch via a private Facebook group, and you know, it was just here and there, but over time and distance, the connection gets less and less, you know, routine. And I started to see some warning signs. I mean, we had had a suicide, and then another attempt. And I started to see things that just made me think like, man, we really need to get back together. We need to kind of remind everybody that you're connected to this family for the rest of your life. You're still a part of India Battery. We're still here for you. And that experience in Kajaki doesn't have to be the best chapter of your life, the most proud thing you do. It shouldn't be. You should go on to do great things based on that experience, and you could be stronger for it. It doesn't have to be a weight around your neck for the rest of your life either. So how do we do it?
I think that's called post-traumatic growth. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah, and there are some people doing amazing work in that space that have been a great guide to me as we kind of develop our process for Warrior Reunion Foundation and how we do our reunions. It was going to be a one-off thing. I never had this idea, like, I'm going to start a nonprofit and we're going to do
yeah.
It was just, I want to do a reunion for my guys.
So you're just continuing to hopefully be a leader for them, right? And even though the venues change, it's not
yeah.
like they don't, it's not like you still don't occupy that space, you still don't occupy that role. And you're seeing, as you said, you're seeing signs, but this is originally just focused on your guys.
Yeah, and I needed them as much as they needed, you know, probably more than they needed me. I just wanted to see them again. I mean, we loved each other. We still do. It's a family. There's no question about it. So we start talking about, I start trying to figure out, like, how do I do this? And start talking with some people about what I want to do. And it's just amazing when you start talking to people and share your story, the level of support and the people that rise up to try to help you make things like this happen. So I'm sitting in a bar in New York City with a friend who I had actually met at a golf tournament while working for General Husterman at a fundraiser. He didn't play golf, so he let me take his spot. And I ended up paired with these three guys who, you know, we headed off, we kept in touch. And the one guy owns a farm out on the east end of Long Island. And I'm hanging out with him in the city. I was there for work and, you know, hey, let's meet up for a drink before I head back down to DC. And we're talking, I tell him what I'm trying to do. And one of the biggest challenges I was facing at the time was, hey, I really want to get these guys together. I don't want to do it in a hotel. I think it's too sterile of an environment. We've all been to those banquet type things before.
Right.
And the people who really need to be exposed out and around their brothers, are the ones who are going to self-isolate in their hotel room and drink a fifth of vodka, and it kind of defeats the whole purpose. So I want to do this in kind of a back-to-basic, like, hey, we're all just back in the field together kind of model. And as I'm talking to him, he just turns to me and goes, well, I'll give you my farm. And I was like, you know, I knew he had a hops farm. I didn't really know what it was. And he was like, what? He said, yeah, I'll give you my farm, Memorial Day, this summer. We'll do it there. And so that really just, like, accelerated everything because now we had a place. We had dates, and those are kind of the two big driving factors that you plan around. And so it was just about starting to get the word out to the guys through the private Facebook page. Hey, this is what we're doing. We're not asking you to do anything other than come. Like, I wanted to make it as easy as possible
right. Because
I know there are going to be some people who want to make excuses why they can't come, but they really need to. We really need as many of the people to come back together as possible. We invited all our Gold Star families. You know, two of them came, which was unbelievable. But the whole approach was just get yourself to the reunion. We'll take care of everything else. Activities, events, food, shelter, all that kind of stuff. We got it. Just get there. And if you can't get yourself there, we'll get you there. Just let me know. Cause I don't want financial issues to be a reason why you can't come to this reunion. So the last thing we need is somebody who's having a hard time making ends meet. Now it's one more thing
right. They
can't do because they're having a tough time. So we were able to, you know, a neighbor I grew up next door to, who's now one of my board members with Warrior Reunion Foundation, is a naval submarine officer, got out and, you know, has become a really successful entrepreneur. And I was telling him what we were doing and he just, you know, wrote me a check. And I didn't have a 501c3, like I said, I wasn't planning to start a nonprofit. So there's no tax deduction for him. He just heard what we were doing and said, here you go. Let me know if you need more. And we bootstrapped the whole thing, and Memorial Day weekend 2015 in a town called Southold, New York, 83 members of the unit showed up.
Wow.
Out of about 120 guys. So just unreal. It was, for most of us, the first time we'd seen each other since we returned from that deployment, or, you know, shortly thereafter as we're getting home. Two Gold Star families, so the wife and son of the first Marine of mine who was killed, Joey Steins, and his parents came. And the sister and mother of another one of our guys, Jorge Villarreal, another one of mine, came as well. It was, you can't put into words the level of power of the connections there, and just sitting around a bonfire at night on a farm with a beer in your hand, reconnecting with guys that you served with in combat years ago and talking about where our lives are now and what are we struggling with, what's going well, what do we need help with. It was just unbelievable. And the way the community rose up to support us, I mean, people donated food, the fire department came out and cooked us breakfast.
And firefighters, those guys can cook, man. They're all on weight control. And then, because they eat good food, man. So, yeah, when firefighters cook, most everybody eats. So, wow.
It was awesome. And, we just spent the weekend on the farm together. Cliff, who owns the farm, another one of my board members now with Lori Reen Foundation, coordinated a big boat cruise around, the Long Island Sound was right there. We're on the North Fork of Long Island. So we got on a boat together and cruised around Long Island and barbecues. And, a buddy of mine who is now a professional musician came out and played music for us. It was like camping out together, but it was like going to the field together without all the bullshit.
Right.
It was a lot of fun. And really impactful, from a therapeutic perspective, not in an in your face. One of the things that I struggle with is the way we often approach even just calling it the veteran issue. It has this connotation to it of like, oh, everybody's, you know, messed up. And we all have challenges we deal with. And I would be more concerned if you went through an experience like that and weren't affected by it. You're supposed to be affected.
Yeah.
That's
you're right. The red flag is if somebody isn't affected by it, which means
right. They're
stuffing it away, and at some point it percolates up. But that should get your attention too.
It does, and so everybody wants to throw these really sometimes complicated or expensive solutions at this, and we just really need each other. That's what it comes down to. So how do you reconnect and kind of reset, refocus for the next mission in life, and that's what this is about. And it's simple, and I think the simplicity scares some people sometimes, but it's not in your face, like, you're broken, all you poor veterans, and here's how we're going to fix you. But we were able to bring in some really good organizations that we believe in, that I've seen the good that they do in people's lives, to just come have breakfast with us one morning on the farm and talk to the members of our unit while we're all there together about, hey, here are some common symptoms of mild undiagnosed traumatic brain injury, because there's not a member of India Battery who was not exposed probably in close proximity to multiple IED blasts. And we're seeing now that a lot of things that are often misdiagnosed as, for example, PTSD, are in fact a mild undiagnosed traumatic brain injury, and the latent effects that can have on you from a cognitive perspective and emotionally and a bunch of other things. So we just had people come in and provide these educational briefings and say, if you're dealing with XYZ, it's normal and it's fixable. You can overcome it. Here are some resources that are available to you. And I'm going to hang out on the farm the rest of the day. If you want to talk more about this one-on-one, come talk to me. If not, that's cool too. And, a lot of us were able to get connected to actionable support that way, without being stigmatized. And when you're sitting there with everybody else too, and you start turning into the guy to the right and left, and you're like, oh, you're dealing with that too? I thought something was wrong with me. Now you're not isolated anymore. It's not that something is wrong with me. This is a natural thing that we're all going through, and we can all go through it together and come out the other end a better, stronger person. That's that post-traumatic growth that you referenced.
So talk to us. So you do this thing, and then where does the idea for the business come from?
Yeah. So, man, it was just such a whirlwind weekend, and we're driving home. My wife was there for the reunion to help with some of the logistics, and she's also a case manager for another nonprofit organization called the Semper Fi Fund. So she provides a lot of financial support and resources to wounded service members and their families and veterans to overcome some of the challenges that come with, you know, medical bills and all that stuff. And so she came to talk about what support they can provide for some of our guys. You know, we've got a lot who were pretty significantly wounded. And we're driving home, and she just looks at me and is like, well, what are you going to do now? And yeah.
And everybody who knows, who listens to All Marine Radio, that the Semper Fi Fund is, you know, it grew out of the 1st Marine Division. And the spouses who, were key wives at the time before we had, anybody who did it professionally. It was a wives organization, and were overwhelmed by the number of casualties, the number of Marines killed in action, the need of all kinds of families. So, if you're looking to give, put Semper Fi Fund at the top of your list. They are awesome. Absolutely awesome organization.
Yeah, she got connected. I mean, she started visiting my guys as they were coming back through Bethesda wounded. I was able to get in touch with her, and I was like, hey, Steph, like, our guys are coming back to Bethesda. Once we put them on the bird, we don't know. We don't get any information about, are they okay? Are their families being taken care of? What's going on? Can you go there? And because she was living with her parents in Maryland at the time while I was deployed. And she just started going to Bethesda and trying to track these families down for us and give us info back, and came across the organization there, started volunteering with them, and then ended up working as a case manager. She still does with them. And so, I went through the process. So also, Mike, one of my board members and my mentor, kind of pulled me aside. He came out to the reunion for a day to just kind of spend time with the guys and see what it was all about. And he just pulled me aside and was like, hey, you know, this is pretty special. You have something here. You might want to think about doing this for other units because you're not the only ones who need this. And that really stuck with me. And so I started trying to figure out, how do I do that? And, we operate very efficiently. We're able to provide a reunion for about 100 or so combat veterans, company sized elements, typically about, in the range of $30,000 for us, all in travel support for anybody who needs it, all the activities, all the food, all the logistics, all that stuff. And so I realized very quickly, if I'm going to do this for others, I'm going to have to find a way to raise money to be able to do that. And the only real way to do that is to start a nonprofit organization. So begrudgingly, I was able to go through the administrative hurdles of actually getting that 501c3 stuff. And I had a lot of help along the way. I'm not smart enough to figure out any of this stuff on my own, but, we got it and, just started operating. I mean, within the first, so we got our 501c3 in, March of last year, 2017. And in April, we delivered our first reunion. So we had that bias for action right away. This isn't about, telling a story and getting on TV for commercials and sending out fancy brochures. Our resources go to reunion. That's it. I have one employee. His name is Drew St. Cyr. He was one of my squad leaders in Afghanistan. He got himself shot 2 weeks into the deployment on patrol with the Brits. We had stayed in touch, and he was a big influence on me and my leadership. When I told him, we were at the reunion, of course, but then we stayed in touch after that and have been close. And when I told him what I was doing, I couldn't think of a better person. I needed a fire and forget weapon because I have a full-time job, and a young child and all these other things. And I needed somebody where I know, like, hey, I'll handle the fundraising and all the administrative hurdles. I need somebody who can run the day-to-day operations of this organization and help these units plan their reunions, because we don't just cut a check. We walk through a guided planning process that takes 3 to 4 months with each unit that we support. And Drew is with them every step of the way, going through all the different planning checklists and timelines and considerations and working with vendors and coordinating all that stuff. And he's that guy. I mean, I know I can just say, Drew, you got this? Yeah, I got it. I don't have to ask any questions. He's got it. And if he needs something, he'll ask me. So he's my one employee that runs the organization and works with each unit that we support. And so April of 17, we delivered our first reunion to Kilo 324, a reserves unit out of Terre Haute, Indiana. And we've been running ever since. So two more last season, both in September. And we've got our first two for this season coming up in April. So we'll have one, not this coming weekend, Easter weekend, but the weekend after down in Georgia. And then we've got another one coming up at the end of the month, in Bluemont, Virginia.
All right. First of all, tell everybody how they find you guys.
Our website is probably the easiest way, www.warriorreunionfoundation.org, just our name.org. That will give you a good snapshot of who we are, what we do, how we do it, and most importantly, why we do it. And then you can get in touch with us directly through the website. We obviously have a Facebook page and that kind of stuff too, but the easiest way is probably just to jump on the website, check us out, and you can drop us a note directly from there.
Okay, give us that website one more time.
It is www.warriorreunionfoundation, WARRIORREUNION Foundation. Yeah, it's wordy. .org.
Okay.
I'm not a creative guy. When they said, what do we name this thing? It's, well, we're reuniting warriors. How about Warrior Reunion Foundation? So,
and it's .org or .com?
.org.
Okay.
.org.
Okay. All right. Or they could just search on Warrior Reunion Foundation. The First of all, Ferg, I want to thank you for coming on and doing this. What I want to do is I want to do one more installment with you maybe next week and bring you back on. And I want you to walk us through in a little bit of detail, you know what one of your events looks like. Because to me,
I'd love to.
Yeah, to me, you know, I'm sure people are intrigued by the idea, right? But, you know, we want it to be fun. You know, are you guys going to organize the shit out of our weekend? Is it going to be stuff
right.
that we like? Is it going to be stuff we're going to roll our eyes and go, oh, come on? So I want you to come back and I want you to kind of walk us through because you know Marines, they'll be naturally skeptical, like, okay, now we're going to go on the balloon, the balloon float in our pink nightgowns. And, you know, we're going to talk about our feelings. What are we going to do? Come on. So,
they should be skeptical.
Right.
There's a lot of organizations out there that, you know, from my perspective are of questionable motives or background, but, there's some good ones too. And I would love the opportunity to do that. In a nutshell, we have no off the shelf product. We have a couple of guiding principles that we test every decision against. But each reunion is unique, and our goal is to help each unit realize their reunion vision. So no two unit reunions are the same, and we're just here to help you get your guys and girls in some cases back together and have as great a time as you can. It's definitely not a mandatory fun situation.
Okay, and what does it cost a unit to use you guys?
Nothing. Just their time.
Okay, well, you just got everybody's attention when you said nothing.
I'm not saying
Marines are cheap or anything like that, but, no, I mean, if it doesn't cost anything and you're a value added proposition. And again, what I have echoing in my head is the interview from yesterday. What saved your life, Dan? Reconnecting with my peers, reconnecting with my fellow Marines, has saved my life. And there's a lot of that going on. And that's, maybe on the extreme, there's a whole lot of people that are living life underneath the optimum, curve, because of a lot of baggage that they carry. And it's such a relief to know that other people have these things too, as you said, like, holy smokes. And I'll tell you what, and the other thing is, for your spouse, if your family wants to attend, right? They're realizing that, oh, you deal with this too? Well, how do you deal with it? And it's just the beginning of living a better life. And so I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome what you guys are doing, and want to commend you for it. And your relationship with Dan Robertson aside, No, he's a good friend of both of ours, and
it was a great reunion for him and his men.
Yeah, and
such an honor to be with them.
Yeah. So anyway, thanks for doing this. I will give you a call, and we'll bring you back on, and you can kind of walk us through in detail what you guys do on a weekend, and again, it's free. It promotes this connection, and there's no reason not to utilize you guys. So thanks for doing this.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. I look forward to coming back with you next week.
All right, bud. Go Yankees.
Yeah, heck yeah.
All right. See you, Ferg.
All right. See ya.
There you have it. That is Captain James Ferguson, United States Marine Corps. Now on to bigger and better things, and he's founded an organization called Warrior Reunion Foundation. Doesn't cost you anything to use them. And what they're about is creating an event that's more than just getting together and getting drunk. Okay, and again, be careful because, you know, if that's the only thing that comes out of it and that you see each other, I think that as leaders and organizers, you're probably wasting a weekend. And well, the time is irrelevant. You're wasting an opportunity to do a lot more, you know, with that time. So, again, the cool thing, if you're a Marine, right, the guys who run this, they're Marines. So they get it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. And I said I was going to do this during a break, and so I normally don't screw that up. And so this is Andrew Pollack, and instead of a commercial break, we'll take an Andrew Pollack break, and more of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We're in here because my daughter has no voice. She was murdered last week and she was taken from us. Shot 9 times on the 3rd floor. We, as a country, failed our children. This shouldn't happen. We go to the airport. I can't get on a plane with a bottle of water, but we leave it. Some animal could walk into a school and shoot our children. It's just not right, and we need to come together as a country and work on what's important, and that's protecting our children in the schools. That's the only thing that matters right now. Everyone has to come together and not think about different laws. We need to come together as a country, not different parties, and figure out how we protect the schools. It's simple. It's not difficult. We protect airports. We protect concerts, stadiums, embassies. The Department of Education that I walked in today that has a security guard in the elevator. How do you think that makes me feel? In the elevator, they got a security guard. I'm very angry that this happened, because it keeps happening. 9/11 happened once, and they fixed everything. How many schools, how many children have to get shot? It stops here with this administration and me. I'm not gonna sleep until it's fixed. And Mr. President, we're gonna fix it, because I'm gonna fix it. I'm not gonna rest. And look at, my boys need to live with this. I want to see everyone. You guys look at this. Me, I'm a man, but to see your children go through this, buried their sister. So that's what I keep saying this, because I want it to sink in, not forget about this. We can't forget about it. All the school shootings, it doesn't make sense. Fix it. Should have been one school shooting, and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed, because my daughter I'm not going to see again. She's not here. She's in North Lauderdale, at whatever it is, King David Cemetery. That's where I go to see my kid now. and it stops. We all work together and come up with the right idea, and it's school safety. It's not about gun laws right now. That's another fight, another battle. Let's fix the schools, and then you guys can battle it out whatever you want. But we need our children safe. Monday, tomorrow, whatever day it is, your kids are going to go to school. You think everyone's kids are safe? I didn't think it was going to happen to me. If I knew that, I would have been at the school every day if I knew it was that dangerous. It's enough. Let's get together, work with the president, and fix the schools. That's it. No other discussions. Security, whatever we have to do. Get the right people, the consultants. These are our commodities. I'm never going to see my kid again. I want you all to know that. Never, ever will I see my kid. That's how I want it to sink in. It's eternity. My beautiful daughter, I'm never going to see again. And it's simple. It's not, we could fix it.